just the warmth of him pressed against the full length of my body. My eyes burned, and I had to close them to keep the longing inside. His hand traced the curve of my spine down to my buttocks and back around to my waist. He squeezed gently and stepped back, still supporting me. With a sigh, I let him help me into my hospital gown and then across the short distance to the waterbed. My feet burned where my calluses had dropped away, so it felt like I was the Little Mermaid walking on knives. Funny thing was that I had calluses on the tops of my feet from anchor rungs and my toe tips from pushing off in the skip hop. But my heels? Soft and delicate as a baby's. I settled on the bed slowly and let him help me swing my legs up onto it. With a sigh that sounded like I was deflating, I leaned back into its support. God, I was tired. The waterbed helped, but nothing on Earth is comfortable after living in microgravity. Patting the area next to me, I slid over to make room for Nathaniel on the edge of my narrow waterbed. He settled next to me carefully, so that the bed didn't slosh me around too much, and curled up against me. Nathaniel ran a path back and forth along my collarbone, raising heat down to my core. Myrtle is talking about making dandelion wine. It was just noise to fill in the space between us. Being gone so long. There are so many words and thoughts bottled up that it's hard to know where to start or what I hadn't told him. And after the raisin experiment, I'm pretty sure that everyone...
Wait. Raisin experiment?
Oh, right. Sorry, I couldn't tell you about that without ground control catching on. That giant store of raisins that got sent up? She rehydrated them and managed to get a fermentation going.
She made wine.
The waterbed quaked with his laughter.
On the moon.
Alcohol is an important part of a viable community. Nathaniel kissed my cheek.
I'm sure it is. How was it?
Cough syrup and turpentine? That got a whistle.
Wow. And you know, moon wine would sell for thousands here on Earth.
Well, Henri Lamont distilled it and made a respectable brandy out of it. I wrinkled my nose. And by respectable, I mean that it mixed well with juice, and by well, I mean you could barely taste it.
I'm surprised you didn't try fermenting the apple juice.
People wanted that. The raisin shipment was at the request of Olga Baumgartner, but she got pregnant and had to go back to Earth early. I shrugged as best I could, lying down.
Yeah, I heard about that.
He sighed.
Someone's going to have to be the first to stay up there if we're going to have a self-sustaining colony.
Who wants their kids to be test subjects? There was enough of a foo-for-all when we started breeding rabbits on the moon. The animal rights activists had been furious. But to quote my grandma, there's good eating on a rabbit. The bunnies we've brought back down have been miserable. Who would want to doom their kid to never coming back to Earth?
The way things are going, they might not want to.
I sighed, nestling deeper against him. That was exactly what Roy and his friends had been scared of. That there would be an exodus from Earth that wouldn't include them. And they were right. Someone would wind up getting left behind, either because of resources or politics, or just sheer stubbornness. There didn't seem to be a good answer. Of all the things I miss while in space, you would not expect the Monday morning staff meeting to be one of them. I suppose it's not strictly true that I miss the meeting, but it's a chance to catch up with friends and colleagues. Also, coffee and donuts. A week after returning to Earth, I walked into the meeting feeling much steadier on my feet. The din of 40 or so people chatting over the aforementioned coffee and donuts gave a lift to my step. The astronaut corps had gotten huge, so this was just one department, the pilot astronauts. We're elite, which really just means that we do more training and, let's focus on the important thing, get better donuts. Shepard saw me first and hooted.
The lady astronaut has landed!
Elite does not equal dignified. My face must have gone as red as a signal flare. I was not the only woman in the room, and yet somehow that moniker had stuck. People crowded around me, grinning and clapping me on the back. Maloof handed me a steaming cup of coffee.
You were amazing. Space germs? Ha!
Helen was amazing. Space germs were her idea.
True.
He toasted me with his own cup of coffee.
But I already complimented her, and you're the one who stayed on the rocket.
Clemens strode into the room, which freed me from being the center of attention, as everyone scurried to grab chairs. Leonard and Helen must be getting similar attention over in their Monday meeting with the rest of the Mars group. On the other hand, a lot of them had been on the rocket, so maybe they'd already talked it all through. I was just happy to get back to the business of space. Before I sat, I snagged a donut. I wound up sitting between Sabia and Imogene. Whatever Clemens started saying never made it past my first bite of donut. Let me tell you, deep fat frying is not a thing you can do in space. A donut is such a humble food until you really contemplate it. The glaze had begun to crystallize as the donut drew the moisture out of the sugar, leaving a sweet shell that separated as I bit into it to reveal a delicate interior. Sugar and yeast and butter and God. God was in the donut. Imogene leaned over and murmured, "Does Nathaniel know you make that face outside the bedroom?" I snorted and then choked. The meeting ground to a halt as Clemens stared at me while I cleared my throat. Face flaming, I took a sip of coffee and cleared it again. "Sorry. Gravity." As if that were reasonable, Clemens nodded and carried on. Funny thing. The director of the IAC has never been in space. He has a bad heart valve and probably wouldn't survive liftoff. Which really got back to the point that Roy and his friends were making. That space was only for a certain percentage of the population. Many people would, of necessity, get left behind. It would be like a self-selecting eugenics program which... honestly, the horror of that hadn't occurred to me until now. But what choice did we have? I mean, yes, people were trying to ameliorate the runaway greenhouse effect. But by the time we knew if those efforts had failed, it would be too late to establish colonies. Sighing again, I put the donut down and pulled my binder forward, flipping through the handout to see what my assignment was. Clemens continued at the front, going through the agenda and talking to each group about their tasks. As I turned the pages, my brow started to furrow, and by the time I got to the last page, it seemed set to split my head. My name wasn't on any of the pages. One of my responsibilities when I'm on Earth is to help train colonists for the moon. All the astronauts have to take turns doing this. Each class of colonists is assigned a pair of astronauts who accustom them to what they need to understand to survive on the moon. I'd been expecting to be assigned a new class, but...
Look, good job with the protesters. We're giving you and the other astronauts who are on that flight an extra week off to deal with the press.
That was not the reward that he seemed to think it was. With a puff on his cigar, Clemens closed his agenda.
That's it, everyone. Get to work. York, stay put for a moment.
Smiling, I nodded, but a groan pressed against my throat. I hated press junkets. Sabia patted my shoulder in commiseration.
Tell him that you need to help me refresh on the moon bus sim.
Thanks. I pushed my chair back and stood to meet Clemens. I don't think he'll let me off so easily.
Worth a try. And it's true, too.
I laughed, doubting that. Sabia had more flight hours than I did, but I appreciated her effort to give me something less in the public eye to do. After gathering my binder, I walked up to the front table. You wanted to see me, sir?
Yes.
He puffed on one of his ubiquitous cigars, letting clouds of smoke surround his face like water in zero-G.
Maloof, close the door on your way out.
Shit. That sounded like I was in trouble. 2, 3, 5, 7, 11. I'm sure it was nothing.
York, you impressed a lot of people during the hostage situation.
Clemens lowered his cigar.
A lot of people. The public relations blokes are clamoring to get their hands on you for interviews. Are you up for that? I don't want to send you out if you still need time to acclimate.
Thank you, sir. There's no astronaut or pilot who will admit to infirmity if they can help it. As much as I hated the press junket, I knew its value to the space program. Whatever I can do, I'm happy to.
Good, good.
He tapped the ash from his cigar into the glass ashtray on the table.
Here's the thing. The space program has been facing some difficulties, and the men who took you hostage represent that. People who don't understand the importance of the program are pressuring the government to pull our funding.
I'm aware of some of the concerns. He nodded.
So we need some good publicity. Someone that people look up to. You...
He sighed.
You remember how you told me years ago that we needed women in the space program early to make it seem safe?
Where the heck was this going? Clemens looked as worried as I'd seen him in years. Yes, sir?
You're right. I was dead wrong.
Words blew away from my head like an airlock voiding into space. Thank you? He snorted, a smile softening his broad face.
People like you. They trust you. So, for the sake of the space program, I want to ask you to be the face of the IAC and, specifically, to join the first Mars expedition.
4.
Hurricane Carla devastates Texas. Galveston, Texas, August 28, 1961. Hurricane Carla, with wind velocities reaching 173 miles an hour, ranks as one of the 8 worst reported on the Texas coast since 1875. Men, women, and children fled before the storm in a mass evacuation, one of the greatest such exoduses since the meteor struck in 1952. All this serves as a reminder that though man may reach for Mars, there are still natural forces on this Earth that he neither understands nor is able to prevent or control. Every second, a hurricane releases at least 10 times as much energy as the meteor released over Washington, D.C. Or, to put it another way, during its lifetime, a hurricane unleashes as much energy as 10 million atomic bombs. This awesome fact should serve to stimulate a certain sense of humility in the face of nature.
I gave Clemens a firm, "I'll think about it," and walked out of the conference room, down the hall, to the stairs, across to the engineering wing, and straight into Nathaniel's office. He looked up from the set of plans on the drafting table with a smile. The smile dropped to the desk with his pencil.
"What's wrong?"
37, 41, 43. I shut the door carefully. 47, 53, 59. As carefully, I inhaled and folded my hands neatly together as my mother had taught me. Clemens asked me to go to Mars.
What?
He said that there were funding issues? My body seemed to be 5 feet in front of me down a long tunnel. Nicole had mentioned something about it, too. On the moon?
Yeah.
Nathaniel pulled out a worn Eames chair, beckoning me to sit at his desk.
President Denley is... He hasn't made any public statements, but according to Clemens, he's apparently considering gutting the space program, despite our agreements with the UN.
I sank onto the leather seat, which creaked with my weight. That would be... Clemens told me that he wanted me as the face of the IAC to get out in front of public opinion. I stared at my hands, which were tight with anxiety. He even said he was wrong for blocking women in the space program and that I was right about needing us to prove that space was safe. Nathaniel whistled.
I didn't realize things were getting that bad.
My exact reaction. He leaned down and opened his desk drawer. Inside was an eagle I'd started making out of punch cards the last time I was home. He bent down to pull it out so I couldn't see his face when he asked,
"Do you want to go?"
I don't know. Past Nathaniel, a fan sat on the edge of his desk, oscillating back and forth to try to cool the room. I mean, Mars. But it's 3 years.
Minimum.
He set the eagle, my tiny brass sewing scissors and a pot of paste in a neat row next to me.
If it were only 3 months, would you want to go?
Yes, obviously. His gaze lifted up to me.
And if I weren't in the equation? But it was still 3 years?
I inhaled slowly and let it out again. Yes, probably. I don't know. I'd miss Tommy's graduation, and Aunt Esther's 100th birthday. I needed something to do with my hands before I wrung them into pieces. Which is why, no doubt, Nathaniel had pulled my eagle out of his drawer. I reached into the trash for a discarded punch card. It shook a little as I pulled it out. It's just... Clemens wants me to be out in front.
So a lot of press conferences.
He winced, knowing my idiosyncrasies. Yeah. And I would be playing catch-up to the rest of the team. They've been training for 14 months already. He was mad to even consider it, but that same yearning that got me into the space program in the first place jumped up and down and tugged on my heart like a 5-year-old pointing at the circus. I could go and see and explore and fly under a different sky, and would you go?
Yes, if I could do this.
He waved a hand toward his desk, papers stacked in the untidy angles of his mid-project mind. A model for one of the second Mars expedition ships stood in a corner.
From space, but I'm not ready to go yet.
It's not a permanent move.
And I want to wait until it is.
He sat forward again, blue eyes sharp with concentration.
That's the difference between us. A round trip would be 3 years of me not being able to do what I love, and 3 years of you doing exactly what you love.
And 3 years away from you.
But if I weren't in the equation, you'd go.
You're not a variable to be eliminated. I lined the punch card up with the rest of the eagle, and the little holes winked with light as it slid into place. If only words fell so easily. There had to be a path through this conversation that wasn't circular. It was hard enough on the moon with only 3 months apart. And there we could talk occasionally and send letters. He waved a hand as if that wasn't a concern.
The program has a teletype set up for spouses and a dedicated radio channel. Granted, there would be an increasing delay, but we'd be able to talk. Look, you were thinking about retiring. Tell me why again.
I sighed, but this is why I'd come to him. I mean, besides the fact that he was my husband, and this was a decision that would affect him directly. Nathaniel helps me understand myself better, sometimes just by the questions he asks. A bunch of reasons. The ferrying I do, it's basically driving a bus. Granted, a bus in outer space, but it's still... I want to matter. Which is incredibly vain and self-centered, and I know that I should be grateful just to have a job and... Nathaniel cleared his throat, looking at me with his brows raised. I stopped and closed my eyes. God damn it. I was never going to get over the feeling that I needed to apologize for wanting to excel. 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13. I want to make a difference. Lightning did not strike me down. I opened my eyes and concentrated on the eagle's talons, but moved to the hard bit buried in the heart of the conversation. But then, if we want to start a family... He picked at a loose thread on the knee of his trousers.
It can wait until you come back.
Can it? I sighed, snipping the excess card away to flutter down to the desk. We kept putting children off, and there were solid reasons, but if I went... The radiation, the time and space and what it will do to my bones, even with the amelioration efforts. I might not be able to have children when I come back.
If you can't. If that's not a solvable problem, then the human race is a dead end anyway.
Nathaniel rubbed the back of his neck, staring at the floor.
Sorry, that's a little blunt. But, okay, let's say you retired from the space program. What would you do?
I opened my mouth, and it was as if the inhalation of breath brought with it a view of that future. I would work in the computer department again until I got pregnant. Then they would fire me. I would cook and clean and raise our child until they hit a certain indeterminate age, and I would start to volunteer for charitable organizations, as my mother had done. I would matter, but in a very small, very narrow sphere. Mathematics, flying, space, those would all be closed doors. Well, damn. Nathaniel snorted. He leaned forward and put a hand on my arm.
Would you be happy?
I wanted both. Why couldn't I have both? But he was right. I didn't want to give up spaceflight. Sure, I was a glorified bus driver, but it was a job filled with beauty that I couldn't get on Earth. Mars was still up in the air, but no. I reached for another punch card so that I did not have to see his face as I admitted my selfishness. I want children, but the life I want wouldn't be fair to them. If it's not Mars, it will be something else that catches my attention and my time. He inhaled as if he were going to say something and then held his breath. I did not push on whatever it was he had decided not to say, instead concentrating on my paper crafting. I say that, but as the bird continued to take shape under my fingers, it was clear that I was answering his silence. Because I layered punch cards to create an egg held between the eagle's talons. His chair creaked as he finally leaned back.
Okay. So, children are out of the equation. That simplifies things. Do you want to go?
I don't know. 3 years. 3 years away from this man who understood me so well that he did not question or try to convince me that I was wrong. Unlike in space, here my tears could fall, but the eagle in my hands was still blurry. Nathaniel pulled it out of my grip, gently, and then folded me into his arms. In hindsight, I suppose the eagle I'd made answered all his questions. It was in flight, but it had its head turned to the side as though it were looking back over its shoulder. It had an egg clutched in its talons. The symbolism was a little blunt, but clear. Even after talking with Nathaniel, I was still unsettled and had no idea what answer to give Clemens. Since my husband still had work to do, I pretended to be fine, which he allowed, but clearly didn't believe. I headed out into the hall to go back to the astronaut wing and stopped. I didn't have an assignment because Clemens had cleared my schedule so I could get caught up on Mars. He'd assumed that I would say yes. I mean, I could take the charitable view that he was trying to give me room to make a decision, but why argue with past experience? Cradling the new punch card eagle in one hand, I headed to the astronaut wing to grab my purse. If I couldn't do any work, I may as well head out. Maybe I'd stop by a bookstore, go home, and sink my toes into our new rug. As I headed into the office, Jasira and Parker were heading out with Betty, who had transitioned from being an astronaut over to public relations. As the astronaut corps had expanded, jobs wound up becoming more specialized, and Clemens had recognized that having Betty working in public relations made more sense than having her be a pilot. She seemed happier there and did interviews on Earth and in space. I gave a cursory nod to Parker, but he smiled at me. I never trusted that smile.
York, we're heading out to the gate to do some autographs. Want to come?
He knew I hated the autograph circuit. Betty brightened, rising a little onto her toes. Over their shoulders, Jasira made pleading hostage eyes and clasped her hands in supplication. It was hard to turn her down when she looked like a desperate puppy. Sure. Just give me a minute to get my bag. I brushed past them to my tiny office and grabbed my purse off my desk. Carefully, I tucked the eagle inside to carry home. When I got back to them, Parker had his hands on his hips and his chin jutted out.
Nolo hiciste.
Ma quattro. Onesto. Jasira held her hands up. Você pode verificar os logs do computador da minha trajetória, mas isso vai mudar a maneira como viajamos. He frowned, a line appearing between his brows as he mouthed a word. Then he nodded decisively and said,
De que maneira?
I raised an eyebrow. You speak Portuguese now?
Trying.
He shrugged and spun us around toward the front of the building.
Figure it'll be useful with the Brazilian contingent on the Mars mission. But seriously? Mach 4?
Yep. Jasira nodded. Is this the Tiberius 47? I settled my bag in the corner of my elbow, more than a little jealous that Jasira had test flown the thing.
It's a beauty.
She paused as Parker pulled the front door open for us.
We're trying parabolic arcs as a way to skim across the planet with a lower fuel cost.
Parker followed us outside, letting the heavy glass and steel door swing shut behind us.
What kind of runway can you set down on at that speed?
I needed the full length at... Oh, hell. Jacira sighed and shook her head. The little girl from the Williams farm is here again. It took me a moment before I realized what she meant by the Williams farm. We'd dropped a rocket on the farm and killed most of the people there. Jacira was staring at a little girl with brown pigtails, dressed in ragged overalls, standing amid a group of similar kids. I'd seen her before, but in that way you see the same people every day without noticing them. Even then, with Jacira pointing to her, she didn't stand out from the crowd. Looking at her, there was nothing to indicate that she'd lived through a tragedy. Poor kid. Betty turned to face us, smiling brightly as if nothing were wrong. We'll have to handle her carefully. One of the reporters out there may have brought her as a plant, and I stepped away from our little group and over to the fence. I couldn't stand to hear about how this child, whose family we'd killed, might be a tool. She was a kid. Handle her carefully, my Aunt Fanny. Slipping through the gate, I waded through a crowd of reporters and their entourage, all of them calling to me,
Dr. York, what did the protesters want? Elma, were you scared? How bad are the space germs?
I had a lot of practice at failing to hear questions by this point, and I kept going, leaving it to them to get out of my way. I walked right up to the Williams girl. She tilted her head back to look up at me. Her voice piped up in that high treble of the very young.
You still going to Mars?
I nodded, even though I hadn't ever been on that mission. Maybe you can go someday, too. What's your name?
Dorothy.
She played with the end of a braid while around us cameramen snapped photos. Someone was filming us, but they could go hang for all I cared. Dorothy cocked her head to the side as if she were considering.
You going to have kids on Mars?
Out of the mouths of children. My chest seized as if her words had evacuated an airlock. She could not have known about my conversation with Nathaniel. I say that as if it had been a single conversation. It had been a long discussion over the course of 2 years, and even if it seemed settled, it did not rest easy on me. But I put on the regulation smile, the one you learn to give while wearing 73 kilograms of spacesuit in Earth gravity, while a photographer takes just one more shot. I'd learned to smile through pain, thank you. Yes, honey. Every child born on Mars will be there because of me.
What about the ones born here?
What about the orphans like her and all the people our government thought were unimportant? And worse, if the space program was stripped down, what about all the kids like her who would grow up on a dying Earth? I knelt in front of Dorothy, my decision made for me, and pulled the eagle out of my bag. Those most of all. After talking to Dorothy and the other kids, I walked back inside, straight to Clemens's office. Mrs. Kerr, his secretary, looked up from her typewriter, smiling.
Well, Dr. York, what a pleasure to have you back on Earth.
Thanks. I nodded toward the inner office. He in?
Yes, and it doesn't look like he's on the phone. Let me just check.
She pressed the intercom button.
Sir, Dr. York is here to see you.
Which one?
The astronaut.
I could hear his grunt through the door as much as through the intercom.
Send her in.
Even after all these years, I still sometimes found my palms going clammy when I had to talk to Clemens. It wasn't reasonable, but the brain does funny things. In any event, I wiped my palms on my trousers before pushing open the door to the tobacco smoke-filled atmosphere of the inner office. Clemens had a cigar in one hand. He leaned back in his chair, watching me as I entered. His paunch had expanded outward over the years, but his face had lost none of its sternness.
Have a seat.
I won't take up much of your time. I settled in the chair opposite him, annoyed that I was already apologizing for intruding. I'll do it. I'll go to Mars. He stubbed the cigar out and clapped his hands together with a delighted grin.
My dear girl, you have no idea how important this is.
I'd just met the kids that our success or failure would directly affect. I'm pretty sure that I had a better idea of what was at stake than Clemens in his insulated office. Anything I can do to help keep us moving forward?
Excellent.
He He reached into the file drawer of his desk and drew out a folder.
I had Mrs. Kerr make up a packet for you, hoping you would say yes. This has the base timeline and our plan to get you up to speed with the rest of the team.
We went through the packet as he gave me a brief overview. Looking at the parameters and seeing how much I'd have to learn to catch up, I started to get excited. I hadn't been pushed in so long that my blood sang with anticipation. Only after I left his office, packet tucked under my arm. Only after I left the building and got on the streetcar for downtown. Only after I had opened the packet and started to read again, did I realize that I'd never told Nathaniel my final decision. Living in space on my own had made me forget how to be part of a couple. 5.
Clergymen seek peace in Chicago. City calm as ministers move through Negro District. Special to the National Times. Chicago, Illinois, August 28, 1961. Chicago's riot-torn West Side neighborhood was quiet today, but National Guardsmen remained on call at 5 armories in the city. Reinforced police squads patrolled the area to prevent a recurrence of the violence that injured 60 persons Friday night. Taverns remain closed till further notice. Civil rights leaders explain that most of the work in the region is for the space industry, but the average education level here stops at the 8th grade because of the high number of refugees from the East Coast whose schooling was abruptly terminated by the meteor. With many of these men unsuited for high-tech work, the unemployment rate is at 18% in the district. They said that community organizations lacked leadership and militant fringe groups such as Earth First had sought to fill the vacuum with some success.
On the moon, I eat in the cafeteria with the rest of the colony, but at home, I cook. Sometimes I stress cook. Sometimes I stress cook an entire kosher dinner. After talking to Clemens, I also made pie. By the time Nathaniel got home, the apartment was muggy and smelled of chocolate, rosemary, beef, and red wine. I sat in front of the fan, leaning forward so the air could go down my cleavage, and regretted my decision to cook dinner while also wondering if I should make another dish. My regret faded when Nathaniel stopped in the doorway, head tilted up. He inhaled and smiled.
Is that your beef bourguignon?
And baked potatoes. And a salad. I stood up, flipping the fan back to oscillate. And biscuits. He set his briefcase down by the door and put his hat on the rack.
Have I mentioned how much I've missed you?
I told Clemens I'd go. I bit my lips. Well, crap. I'd planned on talking to him over dinner. Sorry. Nathaniel crossed the room and took my hands in his. Gently, he squeezed each of them, looking down as if they were something rare. He sighed, but a smile softened his cheekbones.
Well, I knew you were going to go.
I'm sorry, there's still time to back out.
No, Elma.
He looked up and his eyes were wet. I went all over trembles. He brought my left hand up and kissed my ring finger.
I was pretty sure you wanted to go, but was waiting for you to come around to it on your own. In case I was wrong.
But my husband shook his head, still smiling at me, even though his eyes were reddened.
I don't want you stuck on Earth wishing you were in the stars. That's no sort of marriage.
My time away from Nathaniel began almost immediately. The training that Helen had referred to was at the Adler Planetarium. I keep waiting for them to come up with something better than a sextant for navigating through space, but without a magnetic field, we are reliant upon the stars. Granted, we have the IMU, Inertial Measuring Unit, but we still needed the stars as a reference. And since the IMU was just a bunch of gyroscopes, that required a human to look at the stars first, with a sextant. And the IMU has to be reset periodically over the course of a long journey because gyroscopes wander off. So to restore it to precise stellar alignment, we again need to have an astronaut look at the stars with a sextant. I knew how to use one, of course, because I used it whenever I did the Moon-Luneta transit, but the stars we would need for the Mars trip were different. I'd joined the navigator computers and pilots to learn to recognize the Mars transit stars with a sextant. The rest of the nav comps and pilots were already in Chicago at the Adler Planetarium. so I headed out to join them after a bare 2 weeks at home with Nathaniel. My preference would have been to fly a T-38 over, but taking a commercial flight meant that I could use the time studying the reams of documentation I needed to catch up on. While I was nowhere near up to speed, by the time I walked up the windswept stairs of Adler, I at least knew what questions to ask. Don't let the dated Art Deco style of the Adler fool you. The marble might be 30 years out of style, but the planetarium itself is state-of-the-art. Oh, but I do love a planetarium. This is ridiculous on the face of it, since I live half my life in space these days, but we rarely see the stars on the moon. We're buried in tubes, and even when we're not, we have to be in the Earth's shadow for the sky to be dark enough. Plus, planetariums can speed time up and rotate the sky to any orientation you want. I pushed open the door to the planetarium proper with a smile and a giant binder. Betty hopped up from her chair with a grin.
Alma! I thought they were kidding when they said you'd be joining the team.
I gave her a quick hug. Clemens has you out here, huh? Betty nodded and gestured to a photographer behind her.
Is Phil okay?
Sure. I nodded to the man and made an internal vow to ignore him, before turning to the rest of the team. Or teams, really. We had an unmanned cargo ship, the Santa Maria, but the two crewed vessels were duplicates of each other, lovingly dubbed the Nina and the Pinta. Each had two pilots and two nav comps because the IAC did love redundancy. All of them had their noses buried in the thick binders that the IAC had loaded us down with. They barely glanced up as I walked over to say hello. On the Pinta team, Derek Minkowski and Vanderbilt De Beer were the pilots. The two men could have been twins, both coming out of the same military mold of square corners and chiseled jaws. The fact that one was Polish-American and one was South African? It seemed trivial. Their nav comps were also white. Rumor had it that South Africa had threatened to withhold funding unless their people flew in an all-white crew. Whatever the reason, the Nina had the only black members of the Mars team, though neither of them were pilots. For a pilot, we had Stetson Parker, who leaned back in his seat with his legs stretched out in front of him. He had a sextant out and was trying to balance the brass device on his palm. Our co-pilot, Esteban Terrazas, stood up, but his smile seemed slow and stiff. We'd gone to the moon together, and I recognized that look. He was trying to be cheerful while being upset.
Hey, York.
I shook his hand, exchanging pleasantries, and couldn't ask him what was wrong because of Phil the photographer. All of us needed to be on best behavior when the press was around, even if it was in-house press. Florence Gray was also on the team. We'd met at a company party last year, and we were both friends with Helen. Florence was a petite black woman who had been a wireless codebreaker in the war and had a reputation for ferocious speed as a nav comp. Florence, how have you been? I offered her my hand. She looked at it for a moment before sighing and shaking it. Fun. And then she turned back to her binder. That was rude. I glanced around the room. Where's Helen? Florence slammed her binder shut. Seriously? She got up and stalked out of the room. I stared after her, my mouth hanging slightly open as Phil took photos. Trying not to grimace, I turned back to the rest of the team. For a brief moment, all of them were staring at me. Then they snapped their gazes back down to their manuals. Except Parker, who wore a twisted smirk as he balanced that damn sextant on his palm. He stared at me, drew breath to speak, and Betty stepped between us. She gestured to Phil, who lowered his camera. Leaning in, she whispered, "Helen got bumped in order to make space for you." The entire room went red and heat boiled off my skin. What the hell? Apparently I said that out loud because Parker laughed.
"Come on, York. You know the weight allowances. You think they could just add you?"
"You know, I really don't know why I thought that Clemens would be honest with me. That's what I got for believing him. Well, I'll let you all get back to work." My face was still burning, but I couldn't tell you if it was anger or shame. I should have known. I should have known that they couldn't just add me. Each ship had only 7 people on it. Of course they couldn't just add me and all the supplies for an additional mouth, not without taking something else off. And if they were adding a nav comp, of course they had to subtract one to keep the equations even. I took a step back, shaking, before I started out of the room. God-damned Clemens. He should have told me.
Where are you going, York?
A metal-on-metal squeak sounded from Parker's seat as he stood. I'm going to quit so Helen can have her spot back.
Good. That's the right thing to do.
His footsteps followed me up the carpeted aisle of the planetarium.
Want me to fly you back so our team can be restored faster?
He was just doing that to annoy me, but I stopped in the aisle and spun to face him. Yes. Yes, I would. Parker and I, we still didn't really get along, but after 4 years of working together, we had managed to achieve a professional respect for one another. By the time we got through the pre-flight checklist and were in the air, I'd calmed down enough to remember to try to be civil. Sitting in the back seat of the T-38, I had a view of Parker's helmet and the sound of wind around me for company. He'd taken us up above the clouds into glorious clear blue skies. I let out a sigh loud enough to activate the vox and carry my voice over the mic to him. Sorry. I should have known.
Yeah. You should have.
Asshole. I mean, he was right, but he didn't have to rub it in. His helmet turned as if he were going to look over his shoulder at me.
But Clemens should have said something. That was a shit move.
I wouldn't have said yes if I'd known.
I don't doubt that.
Below us, the clouds rolled past in a sea of undulating white.
Honestly, I was surprised you would agree under any circumstances.
Mars?
You turned it down before.
I had. Back when the program was first being considered, I decided that I would be content with the moon and hadn't wanted to be gone that long. The funding cuts? Clemens wants to use me again. Parker sighed and shook his head.
You know, it'd be nice if the space program were run by an actual scientist instead of PR flunkies and politicians.
We are in agreement there. On the other hand, I wasn't sure what pulling out of the program would do. Nothing good, probably. But I wasn't going to take this opportunity away from someone who had worked so long and so hard. Reynard would probably curse me for it, because getting back on the team would send Helen away. How's your wife taking the whole gone-for-3 years thing? Ahead of me, sunlight gleamed off of Parker's helmet. It didn't so much as move from side to side. The air hissed around us, carrying his silence. Why did I think asking him a personal question was a good idea? We had professional respect for each other. That was it. Never mind. Sorry. Shouldn't have asked. Parker cleared his throat, his helmet moving so that reflected sunlight danced along its curve.
She's...
His voice broke.
She encouraged me to go.
There was clear love and pain in his voice. This baffled me because he'd been having an affair with Betty for the past 4 years. I half expected Parker to follow me into Clemens's office to watch the show, but he peeled off and went up to the astronauts' wing of the IAC. Channeling my mother's poise and southern cold fury, I walked into Clemens's outer office like I was balancing a book on my head. Mrs. Kerr looked up smiling. Dr. York, I thought you were in Chicago. Beyond her, the inner office door was open and Clemens had his feet up on his desk reading a magazine. I spoke a little louder than strictly necessary for his benefit. I was, but something came up. Is the director available? He lowered the magazine and swung his feet off the desk.
Come on in.
When I did, I shut the door behind me just in case I found it necessary to raise my voice. Clemens raised his eyebrows and picked his cigar up from the ashtray.
Is Parker giving you trouble?
No, sir. I tucked my hands behind my back instead of shoving them into my flight suit's pockets. I'm here to offer my resignation. Clemens fumbled his cigar and it plummeted to the ground, trailing smoke and ash like a dying rocket.
What the...
He snatched it off the floor.
What did Parker do?
He's not giving me trouble. Although the fact that Clemens's mind jumped there immediately did not bode well for the mission. In fact, he offered to fly me back from Chicago, which I very much appreciated. My intention is to resign so that Helen Carmouche can be restored to the Mars expedition. If Clemens had ever paid any attention, he would know that the more formal and polite I became, the angrier I was.
Don't be absurd.
He clearly had not been paying attention. Absurd? I strode forward and leaned my hands on his desk. The beautiful thing about planning to quit is that for once, I didn't care what he thought of me. Helen Carmouche has been in training for this mission for over a year. She's just as good of a computer as I am. What's absurd is pulling her off a mission and replacing her with someone who will be playing catch-up the entire time. Clemens stubbed out his cigar and held up both hands in supplication.
I would like to ask you to reconsider.
No, absolutely not.
Carmouche agreed to the switch.
He stood, coming around the desk to where he could stare down at me.
Our agreement is that she and her husband will both be in the next colonist group, if she still wants to go. We need you on this mission.
For publicity? In all other ways, I am a liability, because I am replacing a trained mission specialist.
Yes.
Clemens buttoned his jacket, then unbuttoned it again, shrugging.
I am aware of the risks, and yes, it will make a difference. It has already made a difference in which senators are willing to back the mission. Do you realize how many of them have daughters who are in Lady Astronaut clubs? Because of you.
That pit of dread opened up in the base of my stomach. Is that really enough reason to jeopardize the expedition and all the people on it?
You already said yes. You are willing to do the catch-up work.
Because you failed to inform me that I would be replacing someone. I shook my head, but it was impossible to get Helen's excitement about this mission out of it. This is not what I agreed to do.
If you back out, it will look very bad indeed. We've already made announcements.
Clemens placed his hands on his hips, and even without the cloud of cigar smoke, he loomed over me.
Think of what the press will say if the first woman astronaut quits the mission.
Jasira was the first woman in space.
You are the first American woman, and Jasira is leaving to get married.
He shook his head.
It's the American Congress that we have to convince to stay with the program. If they pull their funding, the mission won't happen. Period.
I clenched my jaw as if that would allow me to bite down on my heart and stop its galloping pace. This is wrong.
It is necessary.
I hated him in that moment, because he made sense. Maybe it would be different if I didn't have a brother who was a meteorologist, giving me all the latest information about Earth's runaway greenhouse effect. Maybe it would be different if I hadn't lived in space and seen the clouds and the great storms wreaking havoc on our coasts. I am willing to do this much. I will delay my decision until I have spoken with Helen. 6.
Italy suffers in heat wave. Rome, Italy, September 4, 1961. AP. Water is to be rationed in Rome, which is suffering through Italy's worst heat wave and drought in 70 years. At least 21 deaths have been attributed to the heat, the accompanying storms, and the drowning of persons seeking relief. Scattered electrical storms yesterday brought respite from the heat to some areas, but not to Rome. Lightning killed several persons and dozens of farm animals and caused a number of fires. Rome's water company announced a rotation rationing program that will deprive every home of water for most of one day next week.
Clemens glared at the floor, the flesh of his neck turning a livid red where it rolled over his collar. He nodded decisively and turned to snatch his cigar and magazine off his desk.
Use my phone.
I'll go to her house and...
Please.
His plea shocked me into silence. Clemens turned the magazine to face me so I could see the cover. Time magazine had a huge artist's rendering of Mars with a single word on it. Why?
If you decide not to go, I need to know immediately, because it's going to take everything this agency has to keep that from being meteoric.
I swallowed and nodded, but I wasn't going to back down. Once he was out of the room, I picked up his phone and called Helen at home. Curling the cord around my hand, I leaned against his desk, not quite able to sit in his chair. My sense of propriety is decidedly odd at times. The phone rang three times before Helen picked up.
Carmouche residence. This is Helen Carmouche speaking.
Hi. It's Elma? I cleared my throat into the silence on the line. That slight crackle of static answered a world of questions. I just found out that they bumped you, but Clemens said that you agreed with it? Is that really okay? I get to spend more time with Renard. But you've been working so hard. I waited to give her time to respond, with only the faint sounds of her breathing to let me know that the line was still open. I told Clemens that I wouldn't go unless you were okay with being bumped.
Yes, of course, Elma. You have my permission to go.
When Helen gets excited, her Taiwanese accent comes back. When she's angry, she sounds like mid-Atlantic aristocracy. Right now, I was talking to the Katharine Hepburn of anger.
Look, if you're not okay, I'll back out. I mean, I already told him that. For God's sake! I told you I was okay with it. I give you permission to go. You want me to say I'm happy? I'm not. You're my friend, but you can't ask me to lie to make you feel better.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean...
I'll tell him I won't go. That would be sacrificing a piece for no good reason.
Helen sighed and some of the fury went out of her voice.
You've been in all the papers already. If you pull out and make a stink, that would remove support for the program. I understand the situation, but I am not okay with it.
We can spin it, I'm sure. Point to the time you've been training and how you're more qualified.
Be realistic. This isn't about training.
In her words, I heard the echo of Roy and the Earthfirsters.
I know where I stand in America and in the space industry. If I acquiesce, then they will put me on the second wave of ships. If I had balked, he would have found an excuse to ground me permanently and replaced me anyway. Of course I said yes, and smiled when doing so. It was the only intelligent move available.
Then let's use the fact that I'm apparently invaluable. I'll tell Clemens that I won't go unless you do. Even as the words left my mouth, I knew all the reasons that idea wouldn't fly. We both knew the allowances on the ships. But Helen voiced them for me. I could hear her disdain in her sniff.
They couldn't add another team member because of the additional resources and weight that would require.
But I stopped, unsure how to answer that. There had to be a way.
They would have to replace someone else, and thank you, but no. I do not want to be the person who got someone else kicked off the mission.
That would leave the team with two people to hate. The phone pulled my head down to my chest with the gravity of her words.
I'm sorry.
I know. Helen packed so much into those two words. I know you regret it. I know you don't want me to blame you. I know that nothing will change.
I'll wait. It's not fair. But at least it's a familiar strategy.
And that just made me feel grosser. As soon as I'd said yes again, it was as if the publicity department at the IAC went into overdrive. Maybe they had already planned these things. Or maybe it was the magazine. Magazines. Because it wasn't as if the timepiece had been the only negative article. The resistance to the space program hadn't been that clear from the moon, where we didn't exactly get regular newspaper delivery. Whatever the reason, 2 weeks later, I found myself in Los Angeles standing backstage at The Tonight Show with Stetson Parker. I had taken a Milltown in my hotel room. Now I faced the wall, running a Fibonacci sequence to try to calm down. At least I didn't throw up anymore. Usually. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Behind me, Parker paced in tiny circles, shaking his hands as if he were trying to get blood back into them. An assistant with a clipboard waited by us, one ear covered with a giant earphone, as if he were at mission control. 233, 377, 610, 987, 1,597, 2,584, 4,181, 6,765. The man with the clipboard leaned next to me and whispered,
"You're on."
On stage, Jack Parr said,
"Please welcome my next guests, Colonel Stetson Barker and Dr. Elma York."
I turned away from the wall in time to see Parker snap his genial smile into place. He gestured for me to lead the way.
"Ladies first."
My smile felt brittle and plastered on. Crinoline shushing against my legs, I strode out into the lights and the wall of applause. Beyond the banks of lights and cameras, real people sat in the auditorium. Beyond them, millions of people sat on the other side of television sets. 10,946, 17,711, 28,657. Mr. Parr shook my hand, and then Parker's, and we went through the requisite smiling and waving to the audience before we were seated on matching leather chairs next to his. A silver microphone stood on the floor between Parker and me, and I had to cross my legs carefully to keep from hitting it with my pumps. With a tug on one of his signature ties, Jack Parr leaned over to us as if we were the only people in the room.
"Thank you both so much for joining us. I tell you, I don't think I've ever gotten over being 5 years old. I know it's obvious, but I just need to say it. You've both been to the moon?"
Parker laughed. He really does have a good laugh.
"I can't believe it either. There are days when I have to pinch myself. And Dr. York, you live on the moon, is that right?"
"Yes. I live in the lunar colony about 6 months out of the year."
"That must be fascinating."
Jack Parr leaned closer, smiling with all the fidgety interest of a child.
"What's it like?"
"More like Earth than you might think. I pilot one of the transport ships, ferrying geologists and miners out to various sites. I have a regular route, so it's not much different from being a bus driver, really." Beside me, Parker chuckled.
"Don't let Dr. York sell herself short. Piloting one of these ships requires a lot of skill because of mass cons."
Jack Parr raised his eyebrows almost to his hairline.
"Mass cons? Is that a convicted mascot?"
Bless him for making me laugh, even if it was a poor joke. Or I would have gaped at Parker's compliment. "Mass con is short for mass concentration. There are local heavy spots on the moon where the rocks have more density, so it causes the ship to dip unexpectedly."
"Wait, there are really spots where there is more gravity on the moon?"
I nodded. "Here on Earth, too, but it's so slight that you wouldn't notice it. It's one of the reasons we can't automate a ship around the moon, because the math is too complicated for a mechanical computer that's small enough to fit on the spacecraft." Not that anyone wanted to hear about math. My job was to extol the virtues of the Mars program. "But the lunar colony does give a taste of what our Mars colony will be like. It's much the way living on the frontier must have felt for early Americans."
"Is it true that there's an art museum on the lunar colony?"
"It is." I smiled even more brightly, until it felt like my skin was going to crack. "Although it's only about 1.5 meters of closet, all told. We have a tiny rotating exhibit created by the colonists, with sculpture, textiles, and drawings." Parker gave his own shit-eating grin.
"It's true. I enjoy stopping in every time I head to the moon. It helps me realize that humanity will thrive among the stars. Our drive to create art is one of the most defining features of mankind."
"I can't wait to see how Mars will inspire artists." Was it possible to be any perkier? But this is what they had asked me to do. My stomach twisted with each smile I gave, and for once in my life, it wasn't just anxiety. It was the way I was being used at the expense of others.
"Now, I want to ask a more serious question, if I may. Dr. York, on your return to Earth, your ship was hijacked by a group of terrorists. What was that like?"
"They weren't really terrorists. Just a bunch of men out hunting who held me at gunpoint, who were worried about being left behind on Earth." Parker jumped in, leaning forward with his elbows on his knees, fingers pressed together like a rabbi in thought.
That's something I love so much about our job at the IAC. We go out into space to prepare the way for others. Back in Frontier days, you wouldn't have dreamed of taking Grandma across the country in a covered wagon, but now, she can go anywhere. It's the same for space.
Right. We're making space safe for grandmas. When I'm spouting drivel like this, it's hard to tell that I have a PhD in physics and mathematics. But maybe this was a chance to talk directly to the people like Roy, who were afraid they would get left behind. It's such a team effort. We have people from all over the world working in the space program. For instance, Helen Carmouche is a NavComp, Navigator Computer, who was originally from Taiwan. She's the one who came up with the idea that got everyone safely off the Cygnus 14.
And you're the one who executed that idea.
Parker's grin was blinding.
That's why we're so lucky to have you going to Mars with us.
Asshole. Oh, I'm just part of a larger team. We've got Camilla Shamoon from Algeria, and Esteban Terrazas from Spain, and Rafael Avelino from Brazil, just to name a few. I wanted to turn to the cameras and appeal directly to Roy, who was probably in a prison somewhere, and just say flat out, look, it's not just white people. We're all working together. Instead, I said, it's like a flying world's fair up there. That got a laugh from the audience. Yay, bully for me and rah-rah. Parker laughed with them and leaned over to Jack Parr.
And of course, everyone going has more than one expertise.
Jack Parr raised his eyebrows.
Oh, and what's yours? Mission commander, but I'm also a pilot and a linguist.
Parker jerked a thumb over at me.
Dr. York is a physicist, computer, and pilot. She's a triple threat. If only she played chess, she'd be a complete package.
I kept a smile on my face and laughed right along with them because, of course, Helen played chess. I didn't. After we finished with the Tonight Show, I should really have gone back to the hotel and studied, but how could I be so close to my brother and not visit? When the car service dropped Parker and me off at our hotel, Herschel was already waiting with Tommy on one of the plush velvet sofas gracing the lobby. My brother hadn't changed much since I'd seen him at Rosh Hashanah, but Tommy seemed to have grown a foot. I guess that's the difference between 16 and 17. His face still had the baby softness of boyhood, but his jaw was firming into the same lines as my dad's. My nephew jumped up, all puppy-eager smiles. He'd already crossed the room to hug me while Herschel was still wrangling his crutches.
Aunt Alma!
Tommy rocked me back a step with his enthusiasm. Please, God, never let this child of my heart lose his joy. Child of my heart. For a moment, the reminder that I would have no child of my body nearly blinded me, and I clung to Tommy with an unnecessary fervor.
Hey, Tiger!
I released him and turned to Parker, who had stopped when I did. May I introduce?
Gee, you're Stetson Parker!
Parker gave that aw-shucks grin of his.
Yes, I am.
He offered Tommy his hand and they shook man to man.
You must be Tommy.
You could have knocked me over with a feather. To the best of my knowledge, I had never discussed my nephew with... No, I had. The death sim. All of the astronauts had workshopped what to do in case we died on the moon mission. We'd gone into great detail about who to contact and in what order. So Parker knew about Tommy the same way I knew his twin boys were Elmer and Watson.
Yes, sir, I am.
Tommy was still shaking Parker's hand, but his chest was three sizes larger, thinking that I'd talked about him. Herschel swung up to us with the slight click of his leg braces.
Tommy, I'm sure Colonel Parker has things he needs to do. Alas, I do.
Parker retrieved his hand and very convincingly faked a rueful smile.
And I'm sure you want to spend time with your aunt.
There are things I notice, having a brother who survived polio. Parker didn't look at Herschel's crutches or glance down at his leg braces. Most people do, then make some pained expression. Parker, for all his flaws, gave my brother the gift of normal. With a wink at Tommy, Parker strode away from us like the great American hero. Over his shoulder, he called back,
"Don't keep her up too late. She has homework, and it's a school night."
Jerk. True, but so unnecessary. I turned back to Tommy and Herschel. Want to step into the restaurant? I'm famished. And I could use a drink. Thank goodness the restaurant kept Hollywood hours.
Sounds great.
Herschel swung along next to me toward the hostess stand at the side of the lobby.
Aunt Esther sends her love. Doris, too.
Mom couldn't come because Rachel is grounded.
Tommy shook his head, trying for the seriousness of an adult.
She was smoking.
What? My 13-year-old niece had been smoking?
Tommy.
Herschel frowned over the rim of his spectacles at his son.
That's not your story to tell.
It's just Aunt Elma.
Herschel cleared his throat.
I'm not sure that your sister would agree.
The process of getting seated in the restaurant forestalled the laundry list of questions that I had. I just couldn't picture my niece with a cigarette. She was 13. No, 14, but still. Goodness. She'd be 15 when we left for Mars. And 18 when I came home. Tommy would be in college.
Elma.
Herschel put a hand on my wrist.
What's wrong?
Hmm? I blinked back to awareness, my eyes stinging. Just a long day. He glanced at my nephew. I'm not sure if I was relieved that Tommy was there, because Herschel couldn't ask probing questions, or disappointed that I couldn't tell my big brother everything. Not really. What was there to tell? Nathaniel and I weren't going to have children, and I don't think that decision would be a surprise to anyone, least of all my brother. Herschel fished in his pocket.
Looks like they have a jukebox. Tommy, why don't you pick out some music for us?
Like a rabbit, my nephew had snatched up the dimes and was out of the booth. Herschel immediately turned back to me.
So?
I sighed and shook my head. You know me too well.
And I know that you're stalling. He'll be back soon.
I just realized how old they'll get while I'm gone. I shrugged and spun my water glass on the table. I hadn't done the math.
That is the first time I've ever heard you say you hadn't done math.
I stuck my tongue out at him. I'm a grown-up, clearly. I have enough trouble with how fast they're growing up without missing 3 years. And what's going on with Rachel? He glanced over his shoulder at Tommy, who was apparently reading the details of every song in the jukebox.
He doesn't know all of it. She was smoking pot.
And you hadn't told me?
It was yesterday.
He took his glasses off and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
There's a boy, who I did not kill.
I can. He chuckled.
You'd have to beat Doris to him. Anyway, he's a senior and apparently very handsome. And he has a car. Offered her a ride home from band practice.
I went cold. She didn't... I mean...
No. That's why he's alive.
The music started and Herschel glanced over his shoulder.
Time's up. Just bear in mind that Rachel will probably be grounded the entire time you're gone.
I nodded, swallowing my sickness